Hey folks, we're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so that we can let you know about new episodes and so that we can help connect you with other people just like you who are asking questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening.
Me? I can, yeah.
Yay. Sorry, that was more than 5 minutes.
That's okay. It gave me time to go accept a delivery from DHL, which was exciting because I got,
DHL. I forgot that was actually a thing anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I've encountered them in quite a while. But yeah, they brought me some glow-in-the-dark shoes, so I was really excited about that.
That is super cool. Are they like Back to the Future shoes or what? What's special about these shoes?
No. So what happened is that I bought the almost perfect pair of shoes several years ago and realized they were pretty perfect in retrospect. And then the producer of those shoes came out with a second version, which was the perfect version. And so I actually got two pairs of those shoes, I think, maybe even three, like just identical pairs, because I'm like, this is great, right? And I'm like, I can't wait till what they release the third pair of shoes is going to be. And then they just kind of threw the whole idea out and basically just stopped making shoes like that at all. So I was stuck, because these are the only shoes that I like to wear now. So so I began perusing eBay for other people who have these shoes in my size. And I've pretty much exhausted the shoes that are out there of this particular variety, this particular size. And I have always worn very conservatively colored shoes, like black and white, basically. And, pursuing this has really kind of pushed me to where I was like, well, you know what? I'm just going to get this shoe in like neon green because, you nice. Know, and so now I have neon green and like some kind of crazy, iridescent blue and, several other colors. And so now I just got a dark, glow in the dark version of the shoe. So I'm collecting all the ones that exist in the world. That's my ambition right now. So
that's pretty awesome. I think there's a moral there about you think you've got your thing, and then you have to expand your horizons and accept the weird things.
I never thought I would wear like really colorful shoes, but but I really like the way these shoes feel, and so it like just made me step outside my box, following that siren call or something. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Now you're really excited to even find them. That's funny. That's a good story. Are you familiar? Have you seen the movie Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium? Have you seen that at all?
I don't think so.
It's Dustin Hoffman and what's her name? You know, the girl, Natalie Portman.
I'm talking a lot about Natalie Portman lately.
Oh, really?
Well, I'll come back to that. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm glad that she's relevant to this conversation. Yeah, right. But anyway, Mr. Magorium is played by Dustin Hoffman, and you would love it if you liked Tomorrowland you'll get a kick out of it. But anyway, in the movie, he knows it's kind of morbid, but he knows when he's going to die because he found the perfect pair of shoes and he bought every pair in his size and he was on his last pair. So he knew it was time to go. So watch out.
Oh no, that sounds actually, I think there was something similar on, Modern Family where he'd gotten a lifetime supply of toothpaste and then like ran out.
Lifetime supply, that's
a little intimidating.
it is because as a kid you always assume Mm-hmm. They'll just keep on giving it to you as long as you live. And then they're like, no, somebody out there has predestined how long you're going to live and how long this should last you. So yeah, that's funny boundaries.
That goes back. Yeah, that goes back to our predestination, conversation. But yeah, the reason we've been talking a lot about Natalie Portman, or she's come up a lot, is because it's Portmantober. And so
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, so
that's funny.
For those who don't know, October is the month where people compose all kinds of portmanteaus, such as Rocktober and so forth. And so Portmantober is, how we've christened this practice. And every time I say that, somebody's like Natalie Portman. I the ultimate one I think I came up with this morning was like Natalie Portman Tobler Roan. Yeah, that was what it is. Doing a lot of mashups, which is, I don't know, a weird thing to do, but so.
No, it's not that weird. Like I mentioned before, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I'm not ready to reveal my portmanteaus yet because they're either terrible or they're so great that they need to be saved for the end. Yes. I haven't decided which one they are.
It's always on the edge, genius and insanity are right over that line. So I was thinking today we could either talk about the questions. So I kind of put out a little survey, what's the biggest question that comes up when people encounter transhumanism or Christian transhumanism. So we could talk through that, or we could talk through some of the stuff. I've been doing a lot of thinking about the Genesis story lately and kind of what that says about humanity. So I don't know. What do you want to go with? What are you feeling right now?
Well, I'm feeling, I'm open to anything, of course, but I'm feeling Genesis because I just preached a sermon on the Genesis story of chaos and harnessing chaos and creating goodness. And so yeah, I'm there. Nice. If you want to go there.
Yeah, let's do it. So maybe why don't you kind of recap your sermon for us?
Well, it's not so much, it's okay. So there's now I feel like I need to get my notes out or something. No, I can wing this.
Just wing it.
Okay. So you've got the pericope in Matthew 8, 23-37, where there's the big storm and they're on the boat and they're being swamped by the waves and Jesus is asleep in the boat, and all the disciples are freaking out and they're like, why we're dying here. Save us, save us. And of course he gets up and he's all, oh, why are you afraid? You have little faith. And he gets up and he rebukes the winds and the sea. And then of course they're all amazed. Oh, what kind of man is this that even the winds and the waves obey him? So growing up, I always took that story to be very much very metaphorical, which it is, of course. Mm-hmm. And I know you're fond of saying everything's a metaphor, and it is, but I never saw the actual physical act of salvation in this story. I just saw it as, it's Jesus. Jesus is God. Jesus can perform these miracles. I never saw, and I mean, this goes for any miracle story, but I never saw miracles as something that I could do or that was my responsibility to perform these things. And so this idea of that what's going on here, the winds and the waves and everything, there's this idea in Jewish cosmology that's borrowed very heavily from Egyptian and Babylonian mythology. And it's this idea of chaos, and that chaos contained the potential for everything in the world, good, bad, every possible outcome. And of course that manifests very differently in Egyptian and Babylonian mythology. But what the Jews did is they took it, and you have the Genesis account where God's taking this chaos and he's creating order, and he's taking the chaos, which is this terrible, horrible thing. And he's saying, hey, this is good because I made I made something out of this. And for me, this flies in the face of so much else in the world. That's just like, well, this is just a bad place, or there's just disorder, or it's chaos. And chaos is never seen as a good thing. It's never seen as, it's just seen as something that you can never harness, that, you know, and then there's a whole, I'm not even going to get into this. I'll let you take over. But of course there's the whole, I like to see chaos in terms of, in science, I kind of see it as antimatter, kind of. I like going there, but I'll let you take that one because, you know.
Well, no, that's good. Like, I hadn't really thought about that aspect of it. Yeah, God even basically affirms the chaos in that. That's
right.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
And when Jesus is rebuking the waves, he's rebuking is, every time it's used in the Bible in the Old Testament, or I shouldn't say every time, but often it's this idea of removing a demon. Mm-hmm. It's used in exorcisms, and it's, you know, that's hard for me, somebody who doesn't really get the whole demons thing. But when I think of it as the idea of taking chaos and turning it into something else and removing the bad thing and creating a good thing, rebuking is taking wrongdoing and getting rid of the wrongdoing and turning and deliver. It's an act of deliverance. It's a very big act. So for me, my takeaway from that as a Christian is rebuking the waves isn't, you know, Jesus gets in there and he's like, no, this is a bad situation. I'm going to save you. And that I have a responsibility to act in redemptive ways as well. That is an act of faith for me to establish authority over the physical world in that way and deliver salvation in the midst of chaos. So just the act of delivering, the act of salvation that is more than, oh, this is what happens to you after you die. That salvation is something that I deliver, not something that I earn or receive. That's kind of where I am right now in my, that's what I'm sitting at, is that I turning into my, where I am. I'm also, because I'm in Mormon territory now, I'm also hearing a lot about the act of becoming God. And that's something that we don't talk about a lot. And I'm really, I mean, I'm not, I'll never fit in that culture. But I really dig that idea that we are in the process of becoming God. I understand that very well.
Let's talk about that a little bit. A couple things about salvation in the Bible is a much bigger concept. You know, it's like, it's just a thorough concept from the beginning to the end. There's like acts of salvation that are always happening. And, you know, in our kind of Christian world, we've narrowed that down to like one little thing, right? Salvation in the scriptures is something that's pervasive, and it's always, you know, always kind of at hand, where, you know, we could be saved from a lion or from a bear or from, you know, the Babylonians or whatever. And so it's a much bigger idea. But that idea of becoming God, you know, there's that kind of comes up in a lot of different contexts. And what I think, you know, is important in how we kind of start to look at that idea is that, that we're talking about becoming the right God, right? So a lot of times people talk about playing God, and I say, you know, for Christians, we are called to imitate God. We're called to imitate Christ. That's what it means to be a Christian. But you know, when people say playing God, what they're imagining is like kind of imitating like an angry Zeus character, you know, who's like just trying to wreak destruction on the world or something like that. And so, you know, this idea of like theosis, which is a big thing in Orthodox Christianity, is that God is seeking to like participate with us, to kind of you know, the easiest way to say it would probably be like merge with us, but not in a sense where we like lose our individuality, but in a sense where we become more individual and, but are now part of the life of God, you know? And so that's kind of the whole thing from like the Spirit indwelling us, and kind of working, transformation in the world through us, you know, Christ uniting with humanity. You know, Christ is God united with humanity. That's a, you know, that's a core idea. So this, yeah, the whole thing is God seeking to kind of meld with us, but not in a Borg way, but in a way that's empowering and invites us into that kind of work of God as well. So yeah, that's something that we don't talk about a lot in kind of Protestant, especially like American evangelical Christianity, but it's a big thing that is a huge part of how like the Eastern Orthodox think about what faith is and what it means.
Right. I've heard you kind of going down, not down the road, but I hear you talking more about Orthodoxy a lot. Do you want to expound upon that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, Orthodoxy, I think, is a weird thing for people. And I'm pointing at, so there's the Eastern Orthodox Church, and which is basically the kind of institutional church that we might be able to trace through history, gets its start somewhere around the 300s. It really starts to kind of culminate around that time. And then, there are, you know, there are a number of different kind of independent centers of Christianity around the world. And then as we get to around 1000 AD, then, what we start to see is that, one of these groups kind of breaks off and becomes what we know as the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church. And the ones who didn't go that path, you know, are what we would call the Eastern Orthodox Church. And so there have been, between the East and the West, there are some different ideas and different ways of framing things, and particularly in the West, and Protestants, you know, kind of come out of Roman Catholicism and all that. We frame things in like a legal metaphor, you know, like God is paying our debts, that kind of thing. That's a very big operating idea for us. But in the East, it's that wasn't one of their big ideas. And it, what they really kind of focused on was the idea of organic connection. So where Jesus isn't dying on the cross just to kind of pay off our bail or something like that, but Jesus is going through his entire life redeeming humanity, basically living as a human, bringing God into humanity so that humanity can be fully and completely redeemed from top to bottom. So they call it like medical atonement, but it's the idea that God is seeking to transform all of our humanity and invite all of our humanity into the life of God. And so that those are some big concepts that they kind of deal with and that are operational for people in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And I think it's interesting for us to kind of explore that, because, you know, it's almost like a time capsule of Christianity. You know, it's something like our side of the world hasn't really touched for a while. And so it kind of brings back a lot of themes and a lot of concepts and a lot of ways of framing things that we, in particularly the modern American church, don't really have a lot of access to. So that's kind of that's kind of one thing. The other thing is that with that comes this idea that that physical reality is good, and really that's a big idea in all forms of kind of Christian Orthodoxy, whether it's the Eastern Orthodox or the Catholic Church or the Anglican churches or any of that. There's a big theological emphasis on, you know, God created the world is good, material reality is good. And this is why Christians have emphasized the things like the resurrection of the body, because it's like we're not just trying to kind of get our spirit somewhere. It's that we actually want to transform the material world around us. And so for me, that was a big thing. And that idea, where in contrast to a lot of American fundamentalism, you know, American fundamentalism is very escapist. And it's, you know, pretty much like, oh, this is all going to burn. Let's get out of here. Don't invest in anything long term. Don't worry about things like the environment. Don't worry about things like, you know, whether we might be benefited by getting to Mars. That's not a, you know, that's not a concern, because all we're interested in is getting our souls to heaven. And Orthodox Christianity would say that's not actually what Christianity is. That's actually kind of a rejection of the Christian mission to kind of redeem the material world. So I don't know if that gets to what you were thinking, or what other kinds of thoughts you had had from, because I probably have gone off on all kinds of tangents about about that over time.
No, that's exactly in line with what I was thinking. Have you ever been to an Orthodox church before?
Yeah, a little bit. So not, it's a weird thing for me, because like the high liturgy that comes with those kind of churches really does not fit very well with my, Church of Christ minimalist upbringing, you know? And, mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I have the mental equipment to like fully just kind of buy into the actual experience of it. So that's kind of an irony for me, because I am so drawn to the theology and the thinking and the rationale behind all the things they do. But it gets, you know, it's not something that I feel like is like my native language, if that makes sense. What about you? Have you explored?
Very similar. And I have been to Orthodox churches, or one, sorry, before. Yeah. It was Greek Orthodox.
Yeah.
And it was funny how many things were actually very familiar. Mm-hmm. That I didn't expect, like the order, the quiet, the a cappella music.
Yeah, right.
They sing a cappella, they don't use instruments.
Yeah.
And so there was definitely a feeling, mm-hmm. that was familiar, but at the same time, it was funny because, like you, I was intrigued by it because of its focus on the earthy and the here and the now. And yet the thing that I couldn't get into was the ritual, which, yeah. You know, which brings everything together. So I experienced this, and this is the way I experience a lot of churches, is I love to sit and I love to be, and I even absolutely am worshiping, but it's always in this context of I'm a visitor, or I'm an outsider, or I am, I don't even want to say missionary, because that comes with so many kind of bad things, but just the idea that I am here to observe and honor somebody else's culture. It's not mine.
Right.
And I don't think that's a bad thing to say, this isn't mine, but I respect it and I honor it. And I even want to be able to be a part of it sometimes, but it's, yeah. It's not my culture. And that's something that I am coming more to terms with and more accepting, is seeing my heritage as something kind of inescapable, mm-hmm. and something that I don't have to run from, but I also don't have to accept the bad things either.
Yeah.
Which I think that's what comes, oh, well, just, you know, just be more open, just be more flexible, just, you know, this isn't a process and you're part of that process. And I'm like, no, I don't want to be this. So I'm stuck in this weird place where I'm very drawn and very respectful of other religions and expressions of faith, especially the earthy ones.
Yeah.
And, but I don't belong. It's not mine. And yet the thing that is mine, I don't belong there either. So it's it's interesting. But at the same time, I'm accepting that. I don't feel so lost. I don't feel homeless. I just, it's just where I sit. It's just where I am.
Yeah.
So, but I did, I was thinking about recently why I don't fit in with American fundamentalism. What is it that just, I can't, why do I not belong? And it's not because I can't sit and be in worship. I can do that. But why, where's that icky, ickiness coming from? What's going on there? And I realized, if I wanted to really boil it down and get it to it's that idea, like you said, there's this transcendence in Christianity that I understand about redeeming the material world. And that's not okay in American fundamentalism. We are filthy rags. We are wretches. We are awful. Everything about us is terrible, or an echo of something better, or, you know, it's just not good enough. And it never will be. And I reject that. I can't do that. And I realize the reason why I am equally as rejected is because I like the universe. I like it here. And you're not supposed to. If you're an American fundamentalist Christian, you're not supposed to like it here.
Yeah.
So that's really what it comes down to, is I look around and say, you know, I like the world and I believe in it and I believe in the people and it's good. And I look around and I can't escape that. I can't not call it good.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I mean, that's, for me, that's, you know, when I started studying, kind of theology for myself, and started encountering people from, you know, like the Anglican traditions. And I mean, C.S. Lewis is kind of a window into that for a lot of people. N.T. Wright, is somebody I reference a lot. But yeah, once you start going down that road, then they kind of, they kind of point you towards realizing that, you know, Christianity is, has a lot of interest in the material world. And that for me was really the point where I became a transhumanist, is because I realized, oh, well, if, you know, if, this is what Christianity is about, then that means transhumanism, you know, at least as I interpret it, and so forth. And that's what kind of led me as I went into, some early conversations with, you know, with secular transhumanists and these different transhumanist communities, that, you know, that was my realization, that they were trying to pursue some of the same things that they had found or they had found missing in American fundamentalism, but which were part of Orthodox Christianity. And so I wrote an article about that for Christ and Pop Culture. I'll put that in the show notes, but to me that's, you know, even secular transhumanism is like a pursuit of some of these ideals that we find in Christian Orthodoxy, you know. And so that kind of takes us back to Genesis. Like you said, you can't help but call it good. Well, God is the same way, right? Like God calls this good. And I think what we see happening so much is that people in American fundamentalism don't want to start with Genesis 1. They want to start with Genesis 3 and assume that, you know, in Genesis 3 is when things start to go bad. And so they want to assume that everything is bad. But you can't start the Bible there. You have to start the Bible two chapters earlier, when everything is good, and that never changes. That pronouncement never changes, right? Things get complicated, things get screwed up, but God never kind of takes it back, right? And I think that's something that, I don't know, I've just noticed that people are in certain kinds of areas are so adamant about ignoring like the first two chapters of the Bible in favor of the third one. So this is what I've been I've been doing this class on recently, and we started by talking about the Babylonian creation story, the Enuma Elish, which, like you mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago, there's all this kind of themes that are at play between the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Hebrews. And what I think a really interesting way to frame Genesis is as protest literature or as a protest song. And, you know, if you are a group of people like the Jewish people who are enslaved or who are taken into captivity, who are always being oppressed by everyone around, and then you start telling your own stories and singing your own songs to give you a sense of identity, I think that's what we see in Genesis 1. And so I started by actually going through the Babylonian creation story, which, you know, is more or less, it starts with the gods are fighting. The gods are noisy. The gods are fighting. One of the gods says, like, kills another god. There starts to be a war. One of the gods rises up and becomes the most powerful god, slays the mother god, rips her body open, and from the carcass of this mother god, he creates the earth and the sky. And then all the other gods are like, oh, we're sick and tired of doing work. We need some slaves. And so they gather up some garbage and bones and stuff like that and create human beings and make the human beings their slaves. So that's the Babylonian creation story. I just love how, like, so explicit it is about, like, how they viewed the world. You know, it's like, it began in violence. It's violence all the way down. Humans are slaves. Like, nothing there. Even the animals are created as, like, part of an arms race between the gods. Like, it's just all violence. And so you look at that, and then you look at Genesis, which has some of those same themes, but, like, flips every one of them on its head. And, you know, so whereas in Genesis we see, you know, God, he's hovering over the waters, kind of like a brooding hen, like waiting for life to emerge. And then he says, let there be light. He calls forth life. And from the ground, he says, you know, let the land produce vegetation. So he's like, he's inviting the land to fulfill its own creative capacity. And then he, you know, goes through this whole process. He sees it. He says it's good. He blesses it. He names it. He categorizes it. And then he creates a human being in his image, both male and female, and says, you know, you go do this same work. Right. And so then the humans go off and they name and categorize creation and they cultivate life and they, you know, tend to the world. And that's the Genesis view of what humans are and what humans are to do, is like, we are these representatives of God on earth who do the work that we see God doing, cultivating and creating life, bringing new things into existence, naming and categorizing creation. And that's just science and exploration and technology, like, all right there, and art and everything. And so, I don't know, that's been the thing that, like, I've been kind of focusing on over the last several weeks, is exploring, like, the nuances of that story. And, you know, because, like I said, it's almost like these ancient Jewish desert dwellers looked around themselves and they said, you know, this might look like a bleak and grim situation we find ourselves in, but we're not just going to buy into this idea that all of the universe is just terrible and bad and violent. We're going to buy into this idea that actually all existence is good and should be cared for by us, and that we are, you know, these beings with this kind of grand purpose in the world, is to make the rest of the world better.
Right. And I think the difference between orthodoxy or these co-creator with God type theologies and what you see in American fundamentalism is restorative, not necessarily into our, you know, restoring chaos and making something good, but, oh, the good thing already was, and we're trying to get back to that thing. Right. And I don't, it's just a totally different way of looking at the world. One is saying we already had the good thing and it's lost. And the other one is saying we're continually making good things. And it's right. just that, that is what you do. You are yeah. a co-creator, not a passive pawn, basically.
Yeah. Yeah,
that,
right.
that is basically. And so, are you familiar with the idea of, I can never say it right, mimesis?
Yeah.
The idea. Okay. So this idea is very common in pretty much all religions, especially Christianity. This idea that you are becoming, that your idea of Christianity is to become something else. And I mean, you see it in art and sociology and stuff. In sociology, you see it a lot in appropriation. Like, I'm going to take this culture and I'm going to be like that. But yeah. a lot of fundamentalism is just another way of appropriating a culture. It's saying, here's the thing that was good and we're trying to become like that. And what happens is you miss that nuance that you were talking about. And for me, I understand that becoming as totally different. I see it as like, how do I describe this? It's such a weird concept and it can be described in so many different ways. It's more a philosophy than it's basically how is a paradigm created? How is the act of creating created, basically? Like, it's yeah. it's a weird thing to talk about. But I guess I kind of see mimesis, or is that how you say it? I never said it out loud.
Yeah, I think
I've
so.
Only ever read it. Okay. It's like a force. It's a force, and it's inside this closed ecosystem where every cause and effect relationship is, you can just see it happening, kind of like in a video game. You know, we talk about playing God or whatever, but yeah. like, you know, you play The Sims or Civilization or any video game where you're playing God, basically. And in those games, it's apparent that there is an evolution of sorts taking place. There's a movement towards the community you created changing into something else. But there is a point where it becomes, what it's becoming isn't dependent on you anymore. It's dependent on the things you've made, but the world starts playing off of itself and it becomes its own creator. So God creates his own image, and his own image is creating, and it's still you. It's still the same force. It's still that same creative life force. It's still of divine origin. It was still because of you, but it's moving independently. And I really believe that is, for me, that's where my theology rests, is on that. Yes, this is fully divine. Yes, this is good. This is of God. But just because it's moving independently of God doesn't mean it's against God. It is still the same thing.
Right.
And it doesn't, that's a hard concept for a lot of people, because there's this stigma against calling yourself God, or calling yourself a colleague of God. Like, people, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go there, but I don't know how else to do it. I can't not say that I'm not partners with God. I don't know how else to be a Christian other than that partnership.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of things there, that we hear when we talk, talk in the direction of talking about being partners with God. But yeah, the Genesis story and the whole scripture is about God trying to empower us to, you know, to go out and to do, to do what he does, right? He wants other beings who can do that same work. And what you see in you talked about the fundamentalist communities who are, you know, they're trying to get back to something that's been lost, you know, and a lot of times that's functionally like the 1950s or something like that. But I had somebody tell me this is a thing in fundamentalist communities, is basically it's a virtual reality. You know, it's trying to live as if you were living, you know, decades ago or hundreds of years ago or something like that, right? Like to reenact all of those things. And I think that misses something important about you know where this stuff is going. Is that Genesis talks about the world as being good, and with the introduction of humanity as being very good, but it doesn't indicate that that's like then it's finished and nothing new would happen. What we actually get is this idea that, you know, God creates for 6 days. On the sixth day, he creates humanity, which is to carry on this work, to participate in the work, to partner in that work. And then on the seventh day, he rests. And going forward from that, God creates in collaboration with humans, right? So it's not that the work of creation is ever done. It's that now God wants to do that work in collaboration with us. Like the idea that God is going to be the sole actor now starts to kind of go away, because God is pursuing our ability to partner with him. And when we get to Jesus, we get the idea that this has been brought to its fulfillment, right? Now finally humanity is ready to join in that work. And so now, you know, God has fully organically joined with humans. And now, as Paul says, you know, we are heirs of, and, you know, not just children of God, but now heirs of God in Galatians 3 and 4. And we've been invited essentially into God's family business. We're now, you know, seeing behind the scenes. We're now being brought into that work. And so that begins this, according to the New Testament, this work of new creation. And that's why some of the first Christians didn't say Jesus was raised on the first day of the week. They said he was raised on the eighth day of the week, which was the idea that, okay, there's 6 days, God works, he rests. The eighth day begins the new work of creation, which is now in partnership with humanity. And so this idea of new creation in the New Testament, which starts with humans, you know, Paul says, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation, and spreads outward. That's what God was looking for all along. Like, God wanted to participate with us. And the eighth day, you know, we finally get to the eighth day, and that and we're equipped for that now. You know, that's the role of Christ, is that we are now equipped to fully participate in that work and carry it forward into ever greater, like, processes of becoming. And I think that's really powerful for us to realize, and it's also a powerful thing for us to bring to our own creative work, which I think you're kind of hinting at there. When we kind of work with materials to create, we're also kind of evoking participation from those materials.
Right. I had a lot to say about that. First thing, can you check your connection? You're coming in and out a little bit.
Oh, yeah. So. Sorry. Did you, like, lose me for
it was that weird 20 minutes robot there? Sound.
Okay. So, might just be the network.
So just wanted to double check. Yeah. All right. So yeah, the idea that act of creation, there's something that, you know, I like I said, that is what Christianity is to me. There's one part though of what you said, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that I can't either get behind, or my brain is just too tiny and I'm just not there yet, is the idea that it wasn't possible until Jesus came, or that there was some moment in human history where we weren't ready to handle this transcendence mm-hmm. yet. That what was that all about before? And so for me, the way I see it is, you know, I take the text as here is a culture or a community that understands the world completely differently than everything else around them. The ancient Near East cultures are totally different from Israelite culture. Like, it's just, there's, yeah. It's kind of like they're, it's almost like they're taking these stories and saying, how can I mess with these? Right. and just totally, it was a rebellion. It was saying, no, I don't get this. I don't feel this. This isn't right to me. And I don't see the world this way. And it's actually this other thing. But also trying to reconcile, almost like a compromise. Like, well, yeah, I get that this is our culture. This is our world. This is whatever. But it can't be that. There's got to be more. And so it's this rebellion of sorts of saying, nope, it's not just the world is bad and evil. And we just have to make something out of and cut the mother open and create something out of the, and it has to be bad. Like, you know, that's just the means to the end, but, and saying, no, it doesn't have to be that way. And I get that very, very much. I'm all about saying, no, the bad thing does not have to happen. It never has to happen. It does happen. And I believe we need to acknowledge it happens. And that's why a whole other tangent that we could talk about some other time is how important lament is in the context of religion, but that's a whole other thing. But, because I think anyway, I'll stop talking cause that's my thing. But anyway,
no, but you're right about the, that whole take on things was, you know, the Babylonians were, an empire built on the idea of basically, you know, vertical hierarchical power with slaves and all this. Like, that was their worldview. So they have a creation story that reflects that says this is how things are. And the Jews have a creation story that says this is not how things are supposed to be, you know, like, and I'm not sure, but it seems like actually there's something there where the Jews seem unique in having this idea of like, okay, things should be good. We're going to affirm things as good. They're not living up to the way that they should be. So we're going to talk about what it is that, you know, that's the shortcoming. What's the problem? And at least in what we have, I don't see that in Enuma Elish or these other stories, you know, it's just like the world is bad, just deal with it, you know. But yeah, to your point, yeah, I don't think, yeah, it's not that humanity wasn't capable of creation before Jesus. You know, we see through even, you know, pretty wicked people through the Old Testament who are creating new things and who are kind of affirmed for that. So that's not what I'm trying to imply, but I think what I see is that humanity was, as a whole, kind of caught in a dead end, where it seemed to a large number of people, I would assume basically the entire world, that that really violence was the order of existence. And so you get, you know, when the New Testament is written, it's during this time when Rome is, you know, the dominant force in the world. And what I hear Jesus saying is that's a dead end. Like, humanity cannot go any farther forward just by pursuing that kind of hierarchical power. It's not going to work. And so he turns to the nation of Israel and he says, you were supposed to be an example of a different way of approaching being human. But you've bought into this same idea as well. And so he's very critical of the temple institution and all this, who's completely bought into the kind of Roman view of the world and how things are. And then he turns to the zealots who are out to overthrow Rome, and he says, and you've bought into the same idea as well. You're not offering a different solution. You're offering the same thing that's been done, just your side on top. And so what Jesus says is, like, the way forward is, for humanity, is that we are going to double down on love and compassion and forgiveness in the face of violence, and we'll see which one wins, and we'll see which one is the way forward. And so when Christians look at the cross and they say, oh, this is a salvation event, what they're saying essentially is like Jesus went to a showdown between compassion and violence, and Jesus won that. Like, it's counterintuitive, it, you know, it's absurd, but we're saying like Jesus won that, which demonstrates that that love really is the answer. And that's the way, you know, that's the way forward for humanity. And you know, how we splice that up, you know, I don't know. But I do think that it's interesting that there's an indication that there were technologies created in the at this time that they just never did anything with. You know, the Greeks had mm-hmm. like a steam engine and things like that, but they didn't use it for work. You know, they didn't use it for these things. And one of the reasons why, apparently, this, at least, you know, some people I've read, one of the reasons they think that the Romans and the Greeks didn't kind of really buy into technology as a thing to invest in was because they were so sold on the idea of slavery as being the way that they would rule the world. And so they, you know, made the argument, oh, if we have better tools, then our slaves will be lazy and they'll revolt or something like that. And so we can't do this kind of creative work because we have to, you know, pursue this other kind of work, this other kind of technology, the technology of enslaving more and more human beings. So I don't know. I went way, way, way farther than I meant to. But but that's my kind of like rough picture of things. It's certainly not that humans like weren't incapable of creating, but I think, you know, kind of metaphorically, at a high level, maybe humanity or civilization was kind of facing a little bit of a conceptual dead end that was going to keep things from moving forward. So that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Would you say that Jesus, and this is going to sound super dorky, but I know you're going to know what I mean, was a singularity of sorts in the context of the world history, I guess. And yeah. I don't mean in that dorky time man of the year way, you know, like just in the terms of even technology and like that there's this point, I guess I kind of see of like how I see nuclear arms, and you know, there's a point where either they're going to have to be destroyed or everything's going to explode. Like those are your two options, right? And that Jesus is kind of that point in time where the world can choose to explode or not.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I see it. It's not as deep as it has, you know, it really is just like, here's the guy who said, you know, this is all going to go very, very badly if we don't do something about this.
And, I agree. Like we have a tendency because we read things in theological ways to then avoid the historical and practical aspects, you know, to read theology in such a way as it cuts out those things. So, you know, you'll see this tendency in people where they talk about Jesus being God and they want to downplay the idea that Jesus is human. And of course, Christian Orthodoxy has said, you can't let go of either of those ideas. You have to hold on to both of them. But American fundamentalism actually tends to downplay the idea that Jesus was human. And so there's a similar thing going on here, you know, where we buy so heavily into the theological meaning of what Jesus was doing and so forth, that we refuse to see kind of the historical context and all that. But the scriptures are full of, you know, talk about the historical context. You know, at just the right time, God sent his son. Like there's a huge sense in the New Testament that this is a turning point in history. Something has to change. And yeah, I would say, you know, certainly New Testament Christians saw things that way. They were at some kind of big crisis moment in human history, and this was the way forward. You know, Jesus says, you know, narrow is the gate that leads to life, right? Broad is the road that leads to destruction. And you know, I think we can understand that in historical context. And Paul's very aware of this too, that the Roman Empire is going to fall, and the Jewish world is going to fall apart too. And what's going to be left, and what's going to survive that? And so Paul is very concerned that the people he's talking to are investing in the things that are going to survive and you know, be part of humanity's future, not the things that are on their way out. So anyway, I think there's a lot of similarities, but you know, in how we kind of frame like the singularity and that kind of thing as a, you know, this kind
right.
of moment in history.
Right. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, I am a terrible mystic, and I've said that so many times. There's whatever, and I know you're much more spiritual than I am, and it's something for a long time. You are, but for a long time, I felt super guilty about that. Like there's something wrong with me. There's something missing, and it's just no. This is just who I am, and there's nothing wrong with that. Where I lack in mysticism, I make up for in other ways. So this idea of Jesus not having to be even a historical figure is very comforting to me, because and I'm not saying he wasn't, but I'm saying it doesn't have to be. It is when you look at it in the context of history and everything else that's going on in the world, that it is a, you know, when you talk about the singularity is not a person or it is a paradigm. It is a point in time where something changes. I'm a visual person. So I kind of see like the universe, and then there's like a wormholes or whatever, right. You know, and this is a
vortex,
place where,
yes,
there is a vortex. It's like right here. And I just see it just glaring there. And that to me is Christianity. That to me is Jesus. And I'm not saying no way was Jesus a real guy. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying for me, it is much easier, not even easier. My faith can manifest more authentically if I can see Jesus as the vortex in space-time. Rather than this guy that may or may not have existed. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think what you're getting at is like it's not just, you know, it's like we frame it so much in terms of this thing of like, you know, when I draw a whiteboard, you know, kind of diagram in the sky, do I have Jesus in the right box or whatever, you know? And it's this really abstract, categorical, metaphysical question that has nothing to do with the world, right? And in fact, that's not what Christianity does. Christianity is right in the middle of the world, dealing with all of these kind of streams of cause and effect and thought and all this. And yeah, right at the center of it, you know, that's what we're looking at. Like in a big sense, I think I agree. When we talk about, you know, about the things that happen in the New Testament and so forth, we're saying essentially there is a center point of human history here. Like there's something that where things go in one side and, you know, we don't know what's going to come out the other side. Everything could be different. And G.K. Chesterton says this, I think in his book, Everlasting Man, he talks about basically there are times when you find the roads converge and then diverge again. And he said, sometimes we, you know, that's how our vision works. But it's also sometimes a true thing about reality. Like we come to a point and like all roads lead out from here, you know? And so, so yeah, I think there's, you know, he has this idea that we're calling like singularity of there's this coming together of ideas and crucial decisions at this one moment in history. And the question in the New Testament is, you know, which way will humanity take?
Right. And that's what's so frustrating about fundamentalism is it's trying to get back to that really horrible point in human history.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and that there's a reason why things were the way they were and why social structures were the way they were. And right. that wasn't a good thing or necessarily a good thing. And we've come so far from that. I mean, yes, the world is still full of horrible, horrible things,
right.
but no, there's a huge difference between, I mean, I truly believe there's nothing new under the sun. And I'm not saying that this is, you know, that humans are so much more amazing than they were before. I think, you know, but there is a social progress, and that progress is good. It is the act of creation. It is taking the waters of chaos and creating goodness out of it. And I see a pattern of goodness. Yes, there's going to be fallbacks. Yes, there's going to be horrible, horrible wars and Holocausts and things happening. But in the midst of all that, you see this forward motion towards goodness. And that's what I see in the world today, and that's what I want to continue. And it's so difficult because you have fundamentalism standing in your way, or at least mine, or used to be, constantly. I ran away, so it's not there anymore. But just standing in your way constantly, trying to push you back to that place. And right. And I get that. I get why people want that and they see the truth in that. And I'm not knocking people who follow that. I'm just saying this is why I am such a aggressive force against that. Is I'm saying, no, this is good. Things are good. The world is good. And I actively, aggressively reject that idea. Yeah. And that's a hard place to be in Christianity.
Well, you know, but I think that's, you know, that's on their part, a rejection of, you know, Christ in the New Testament says, you know, I'm making all things new. You know, this is a thing that is supposed to be going on in the world. And the fact that we have been able to observe progress is a testimony to the idea that the Spirit of God is working in the world. It's not somehow counter to that. It's an affirmation of that. And it's just an irony of history that we've, you know, in our little part of the world, we've gotten so turned around on that now you and I, you know, might seem a little bit revolutionary or something to say that, hey, actually, you know, things could get better and we should be working to make them better. And that's actually a thing, thing that should happen. Yeah, yeah. So,
oh well.
Yeah. So I think I've got a hard stop, and I think you do too. So this is probably a good place to close. But yeah, we covered a lot of interesting ideas. I'm sure we'll keep exploring more in depth in the upcoming weeks. But
yep.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.